And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today's September 28th. 271st day of this year. Leap year is 272nd. 94 days remain till this year is over with. And so many people will be happy when it ends. In 48 B.C., Pompey is assassinated by the order of King Ptolemy XIII when he arrived in Egypt. 235, Pope Pantheon resigns, exiled to the mines of Sardinia along with Hippolytus of Rome. 351, Constantinus II defeats Magnentius, who was a usurper for the throne. 935, Duke Wenceslaus I of Bohemia, murdered by a group of nobles led by his brother, Boleslaus I, who succeeds him as Duke. 995, Boleslaus II, Duke of Bohemia, kills most members of the rival Slavonic dynasty. 1066, William the Conqueror, one of my ancestors, lands in England, beginning the Norman conquest. 1106, King Henry I of England defeats his brother Robert Curthose at the Battle of Tichebray. 1238, King James I of Aragon conquers Valencia from the Moors. And shortly after that, he proclaims himself King of Valencia. 1322, Louis IV, Holy Roman Emperor, defeats Frederick I of Austria in the Battle of Mohldorf. 1538, the Ottoman-Venetian War. The Ottoman Navy scores a decisive victory over a Holy League fleet in the Battle of Pravinza. 1542, Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo of Portugal arrives in what's now San Diego, California. 1779, American Revolution. Samuel Huntington is elected President of the Continental Congress, succeeding John Jay. 1781, American forces backed by a French fleet begins the siege of Yorktown, and the beginning of the end for English domination. 1787, the Congress of the Confederation votes to send a newly written constitution to the state legislatures for approval. 1821, Declaration of Independence of the Mexican Empire is drafted. Wasn't made public till October 13th. 1844, Oscar I of Sweden-Norway is crowned King of Sweden. 1867, Toronto becomes the capital of Ontario, having also been the capital of Ontario's predecessor since 1796. 1868, the Battle of Alcolea causes Queen Isabel II of Spain to flee to France. 1871, the Brazilian Parliament passes a law that frees all children born after that date who were born as slaves, and all government-owned slaves are freed. Interestingly enough, Brazil at that point in time was an empire. It had a king, or an emperor, as they called themselves. He invited disaffected southerners to come there. In fact, there is still a town in Brazil, raises a Confederate flag every morning. Well, it used to when I was down in South America. 1889, the General Conference on Weights and Measures defines the length of a meter. 1892, the first night game for American football takes place in the contest between Wyoming Seminary and Mansfield State Normal. 1893, foundation of the Portuguese football club FC Porto. 1901, Philippine-American War. Filipino guerrillas kill more than 40 American soldiers and lose 28 of their own. 1912, the Ulster Covenant is signed by some 500,000 Ulster Protestant Unionists in opposition to the Third Irish Home Rule Bill. 1912, Corporal Frank S. Scott of the U.S. Army becomes the first enlisted man to die in an airplane crash Now that is a honor you do not want to have. 1918, World War One, the Fifth Battle of Ypres begins. 1919, race riots begin in Omaha, Nebraska. 1924, the first aerial circumnavigation is completed by a team from the U.S. Army. 1928, Alexander Fleming notices a bacteria-killing mole growing in his laboratory. He discovered what later became known as penicillin. 1939, World War II, Nazi Germany and Soviet Union agree on a division of Poland. Also in 1939, the Siege of Warsaw comes to an end. 1941, the drama uprising against the Bulgarian occupation in northern Greece begins. The Greeks weren't happy with what was going on. 1941, Ted Williams achieves a .406 batting average for the season. Becomes the last Major League Baseball player to bat 400 or better. 1944, Soviet Army troops liberate Kluga concentration camp in Estonia. Now, not a whole lot has ever been written about Kluga. It was a Nazi forced labor subcamp of the Vivara concentration camp complex established in 43 in German-occupied Estonia near the village of Kluga. Commanded by German officers Hans Omieri, Otto Brunné, and Franz von Bodman, and it had 40 field camps, some of which existed only for short periods. It's estimated that between 1,800 and 2,000 prisoners perished at Kluga from wanton killings, epidemics, and the working conditions. Those who survived were transported to the Stutthof concentration camp in Poland ahead of the Soviet advance. All right, let's see what else we got. 1951, CBS makes the first color television available for sale to the general public. But in less than a month, that product was discontinued. As I remembered, it had something to do with radiation. 1961, military coup in Damascus ends the United Arab Republic, which was a union between Egypt and Syria. 1970, Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser dies of a heart attack in Cairo. He was a colonel in the Egyptian army and seized power after he overthrew the king. 1971, the Parliament of the UK passes the Misuse of Drugs Act of 71, banning the medicinal use of cannabis. Evil cannabis. 1973, the ITT building in New York City is bombed in protest at ITT's alleged bombing in a coup d'etat in Chile. Now, I'm not sure they really were involved, but the rumor was that they had something to do with it. 1975, the Spaghetti House Siege, in which 9 people are taken hostage, takes place in London. It took place between September 28th and October 3rd. It was actually an attempted robbery of the Spaghetti House restaurant in Knightsbridge in London. Police were on the scene very quickly. 3 robbers took the staff down to a storeroom, barricaded themselves in. After 6 days, they released the hostages. 2 of the gunmen gave themselves up. The ringleader, Frank Davies, shot himself in the stomach. All 3 were later imprisoned, as were 2 of their accomplices. 3 robbers had been involved in black liberation organizations, and from the earliest stage of the siege and throughout their subsequent prison sentence, they claimed that this was actually a political statement. Police took the position it was a criminal act. Police used fiber optic camera technology for live surveillance, monitored the activities and conversations of the gunmen from the audio and visual output. Feed was watched by a forensic psychiatrist to advise police on the state of the men's mind, how to best manage the ongoing negotiations. And it was important because it was the first time such a thing had been done. And it was very useful. 1986, Democratic Progressive Party becomes the first opposition party in Taiwan. 1992, a Pakistan International Airlines flight crashes into a hill in Nepal, kills all 167 passengers and crew. 1994, the cruise ferry MS Estonia sinks in the Baltic Sea. 852 people die. 1995, Bob Denard and a group of mercenaries take the islands of the Comoros in a coup. Bob Denard had been a mercenary for 2 or 3 decades. He was involved in the Congo. 1995, Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and Palestinian Liberation Organization Chairman Yasser Arafat signed the interim agreement on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. 2000, Al-Aqsa Intifada. Ariel Sharon visits Al-Aqsa Mosque, known to the Jews as a Temple Mount in Jerusalem. The Intifada was a period of intensified Israeli-Palestinian violence, which Palestinians describe as an uprising against Israel. The Israelis just considered a terror campaign, perpetuated by the Palestinian National Authority and various Palestinian militant groups. A lot of this has been dealt with by the treaty that President Trump negotiated. 2008, Falcon 1 becomes the first privately developed liquid-fueled ground-launched vehicle to put a payload into orbit. 2009, a military junta leading Guinea launches a protest rally, killing or wounding 1,400 people. They attack a protest rally. I don't know if I said attack or launch. 2020, Somali and African Union forces launch a coordinated assault on a Somali port of Kismayo to take back the city from al-Shabaab militants. 2014, the Hong Kong protests began in response to restrictive political reforms imposed by the NPC in Beijing. 2016, South Australian blackout occurs. Some areas of the country, it lasted over 3 days. 2018, a 7.5 Sulawesi earthquake, which triggered a large tsunami, leaves 4,340 dead and 10,679 injured that are accounted for. 2018, on the occasion of the 100th anniversary of the end of the First World War, International Project Tree of Peace was established. One of the trees was planted personally by Zuzana Kapotova, President of the Slovak Republic. And in 551, Confucius, Chinese teacher, editor, politician, philosopher of the spring and autumn period of Chinese history, was born in 551 BC. He died in 479 BC. That Charlie Chan was fond of quoting Confucius. Holidays and observances: Christian Feast Day, Aron of Auxerre, Anamund, Conval, Astosium, Exuperius, Faustus of Rhys, John of Dukla, Leoba, Lorenzo Luiz, Paternus of Auch, Richard Raleigh, Walter Hilton, Marjorie Kemp in the Episcopal Church, Simon de Rojas, Wenceslas, Czech Statehood Day in the Czech Republic, Freedom from Hunger Day internationally, International Day for Universal Access to Information, National Day of Awareness and Unity Against Child Pornography in the Philippines, Teachers' Day in Taiwan and Chinese-Filipino schools in the Philippines. The ceremonies are actually dedicated to Confucius. World Rabies Day internationally. Now let's see if we have anything else. Uh, 365. Roman usurper Procopius bribes 2 legions passing by Constantinople. and proclaims himself the Roman Emperor. And Wenceslaus actually became Saint Wenceslaus. He was the one murdered in 935 by his brother. In 995, members of Slavnik's dynasty, Septimir, Proboslav, Porev, Kaslav, are murdered by Boleslaus' son, Boleslaus II, also known as the Pious. The more vicious they are, the more pious they are. And let's see. 1362, Guillaume de Grimaud, elected as Pope Urban V. 1394, Cardinal Pedro de Luna of Aragon, chosen the anti-pope, Benedictus XIII. 1448, Christian I is crowned King of Denmark. 1528, a Spanish fleet sinks in the Florida hurricane. About 380 die. And a tremendous treasure was left. Kip Wagner found a part of it, I think. 1538, Battle of Preveza. The Ottoman fleet under Barbarossa beats the Papal Alliance off northwestern Greece. 1621, the battle at Chocim Dniester, King Sigismund III of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth defeats an invading Ottoman Imperial Army. 1652, English-Dutch sea battle at Kentish Knock. 1687, Venetians take Athens from the Turks. 1760, Russian and Austrian armies occupy Berlin. 1781, 9,000 American and 7,000 French troops began that siege. 1785, Napoleon Bonaparte, 16 years old, graduates from the elite Ecole Militaire in Paris. He was 42nd in a class of 51. 1850, U.S. Navy abolishes flogging as a punishment. 1868 at St. Landry Parish, Louisiana. Over 200 were killed. 1887, the Yellow River flood in China kills between 900,000 and 2 million people. One of the deadliest natural disasters in history. And let's see. 1899, the Transvaal mobilizes its army in a lead up to the Second Boer War. 1904. A woman was arrested for smoking a cigarette in a car on Fifth Avenue in New York City. 1912, SS Kitchimaru disappears in a storm off the Japanese coast, 1,000 casualties. 1912. Let's see if we got anything else. 1928, Prussia forbids the broadcast of a speech done by Adolf Hitler. 1928, the U.S. acknowledges the Chinese government under Chiang Kai-shek. He's the one that pretty much put an end to the royal family of holding power in China. In 1934, for those of you who remember such things, Judge Priest, the film directed by John Ford, which starred Will Rogers, is released. And with all that having been said, we're now going to talk about secret societies. And we're going to start out with one of the best known, Skull and Bones at Yale University. I was telling the story when we ended the last show. Pancho Villa was assassinated and buried at his rancho in Palomas, outside of Palomas. And his wife, of course, did everything she could to preserve his memory. Well, there were wanted posters circulating here in El Paso about the fact there was a $50,000 reward on Villa's head. And living at the Camino Real Hotel at the time, or in those days it was called the Hotel Paso del Norte, which I think is a name they've gone back to now with this renovation. But he saw the poster and said, well, I didn't get his head. I know where he's buried. He was a very brave man by all accounts, but apparently not the sharpest knife in the drawer. So he went down to Palomas and waited for Mass on Sunday morning when everybody went to the church. Went into the graveyard, dug up the body, took the head, and brought it back up to El Paso. Sent a wire to the U.S. Marshal and says, I have Villa's head, send money. U.S. Marshal wires back, Villa dead, reward canceled. Bounty hunter says, well, what'd I do with the head? And the U.S. Marshal says, we don't care. In those days, stores would buy strange things to put into windows to entice people to come in. So he went from store to store to store trying to sell that head. Nobody wanted to buy it. At the same time, the fact that it was sitting in his room really upset the maids that had to clean it. So, the management told him to get rid of the head. In those days, the Camino Real had a courtyard where the elevators and restaurant sits now. So he supposedly took it there and buried it, according to one story. The ghost of Pancho Villa has been seen in that area. But according to another story, Prescott Bush, the grandfather of President George W. Bush, came through El Paso and heard about it and contacted the bounty hunter and wanted to buy the head. And it was put on display in the Skull and Bones headquarters at Yale. They also are supposed to have Geronimo's head. Prescott Bush and some of his friends dug it up from the graveyard at Fort Sill and took it back to Yale. In fact, at one point, back in my misspent youth when I practiced law, I had some members of the Apache Nation approach me about filing suit to get it back. But we never could get definitive proof that it was there. But, you know, Skull and Bones is perhaps the most famous academic secret society ever started. It was either caused by fallout from a disputed Phi Beta Kappa election or because the co-founder, Alfonso Taft, modeled it after a European organization he'd encountered when he was studying in Germany. And whichever story is the correct one is irrelevant. Skull and Bones has an impressive legacy and pedigree, and it's generally used as both an example of collegiate elitism and a punchline for denigrating collegiate elitism. Every year, 15 seniors are tapped to join, some because they are BMOCs, big men on campus, some because of their socioeconomic background, a rich daddy or granddaddy helps. The headquarters, which is called the Tomb, has a lot of artifacts. And there have been many, many stories that there's a room full of skulls and another one with the walls completely covered with stolen license plates. Each one has the sequence 322 in it. The 322 on the group's emblem may refer to the year that Demosthenes died, 322 BC, which was a turning point in Athens' move from democracy to plutocracy. And 1832 is the year in which Skull and Bones is said to have formed. Now, even though these are the elite of the elite, but Bonesmen, as they're known, are still just college students. And some of them, in my humble opinion, are a picnic or a sandwich short of a full picnic. So it fits that some of their antics and pranks are just juvenile, like leaking rumors of mysterious activities and secrets of their initiation rituals. The run-up to Tap Day, which is when juniors are tapped for initiation, includes standard fraternity hijinks, such as heavy drinking, hazing, and public displays of stupidity. And the group is very protective of itself and its legacy. As recently as 2018, it sent a letter to all Yale juniors warning them of a hoax within where imposters were encouraging students to complete humiliating challenges to be accepted by Skull and Bones. Now, it is true, Bonesmen have helped shape American society and politics over the past century and a half. Not only by becoming president, but by helping to elect presidents, congressmen, senators, governors. And some say Bonesmen are guaranteed financial security for life. But we'll never really know for sure, because they swear an oath of secrecy, and if you start talking with them, the moment you mention Skull and Bones, they'll turn and walk away. John Kerry was another one who was a member of Skull and Bones. You remember him? He ran for president, and when he got back from Vietnam, he took his medals up to the fence around the White House and threw them over the fence and said he was anti-war. Talks cheap, sport. Let's talk about Skrull and Key. Members include Cole Porter, Benjamin Spock, Gary Trudeau, Stone Phillips. Even Mark Twain was an honorary member, even though he didn't attend Yale. And Skrull and Key is another Yale organization. Now, it's said that spite often sparks creativity, and being excluded or wrong often leads to true outside the box thinking. Supposedly, the genesis of Yale Skrull and Key is just such a outside-the-box item. In 1842, several juniors who hadn't been allowed to get into Skull and Bones decided the organization needed a rival. They created a new society purely out of spite, thus establishing a rival that's lasted almost 200 years. Though the relationship is mostly friendly, they're having a few unfortunate incidents, such as the bomb that exploded just outside Skull and Bone headquarters right before Tap Day in 1950. Nobody was ever hurt, and nobody ever admitted who did it. Skrull and Key appears to be more philanthropic than Skull and Bones, which is not known for its charitable work. Skrull and Key's gifts to Yale through the years include the John Addison Porter Prize, a scholarship offered annually since 1872. And the group is also responsible for the 1917 endowment that established Yale University Press. And like Skull and Bones, Skrull and Key tends to be mocked more and more these days by current students, as millennials love respect for established institutions, especially those founded on a heritage of privilege. These organizations tend to take it on the chin, so to speak. Skrull and Key may be a little less pompous and self-important than the Bonesmen, but they're not far off either. Now, Yale is home to 41 secret societies in all. The top groups are these two, plus Book and Snake, Wolf's Head, Berzelius, St. Elmo, and the Elizabethan Club. Now, what their purpose is anybody's guess. Let's talk about College of William and Mary, the Flat Hat Club. I know a few flatheads, but this is the Flat Hat Club, formed in 1750. William and Mary, a student named John Heath, created Phi Beta Kappa in the 1770s after he was refused entry into the Flat Hat Club. And Phi Beta Kappa has far outstripped the Flat Hat Club in the years since that time. You know, somebody always wants to be the first to do something, and when it comes to academic secret societies, that honor goes to the Flat Hat Club, established in 1750 at Virginia's College of William and Mary. It said the initials originated from the Latin Fraternus Humanitas et Cognitio, which translates the Brotherhood, Humanity, and Knowledge. Eventually, the group started calling itself the Flat Hat Club. It's believed that it refers to the mortarboards worn by graduation. The group existed at William and Mary for about 30 years, disbanded in 1781 in the midst of the American Revolution. Now, it might have been lost to history, but it wasn't. In 1909, several items were discovered that proved the club's existence and that Thomas Jefferson had been a member. And he'd also revealed that in some of his writings before his death in 1826. 7 years later, the group was reestablished, and it lasted till 1943 when it was shut down in the midst of World War II. A few intrepid students revived it in 1972, and it still exists to this day. Little is known of the society or its activities, but rumor has it each year's membership consists of either 12 or 18 male seniors. Now, where some of these secret societies engage in charitable and philanthropic endeavors for their university and even for other students, nothing suggests that this particular group cares about the anybody but themselves. Now, let's talk about Nakums and Sachems at Columbia University. Founded in 1898 and reformed in 1915. Now, while the Nakums include undergrads from Columbia College, Barnard College, and the School of Engineering, the Sachems don't accept members from Barnard, which is a women's college. There's at least one secret society that existed soon after Columbia University is first established. It was started as King's College, don't you know? In 1754, but next to nothing is known about it. So by default, the Nakums are called the first such organization at New York City's only Ivy League school. According to the New York Times, the group started in 1898, and after an internal conflict, which led to a split, the competing Sachems were created in 1915. Both are open secrets at the school, and each annually admits 15 senior campus leaders and influencers, including women, since Columbia again admitted women in 1983. Now, the two societies have what's called a friendly rivalry, both generally holding that the other group is, according to one Sachem, a bunch of idiots, and both sides are okay with that. Both wear pinky rings to signify membership. Nakums wear theirs on the left hand, Sachems wear theirs on the right hand. And both are prone to collegiate pranks. In 2005, the Sachems draped the school's main gates with an orange canvas in the style of an art installation in Central Park. Now, being an urban university with plenty of non-academic attractions and distractions, Columbia has a very weak Greek system, which makes these two societies all the more odd, I guess you could say. Both support service initiatives like the Double Discovery Center, a prominent student volunteer organization begun in the 1980s by the Sachems. Columbia's student body is famed for questioning authority and turning up its nose at privilege and excess, even though both groups are highly privileged. Therefore, the student newspaper, The Spectator, and other campus publications have published the names of Nakums and Sachems in recent years to little effect, of course. In fact, many Columbia students don't even know the true groups even exist. Well, let's turn to the University of Virginia. a group called the Seven. The only way to get in touch with the Seven is to leave a letter addressed to them on the Thomas Jefferson statue in the university's rotunda. Very, very little is known about this group. It was started about 1905. Now, there are secret societies, and there are secret societies. Secret societies are not so hush-hush. They draw winks and smiles and not even much curiosity. But secret societies are so mysterious that people know next to nothing about them. Take, for instance, the group known as the Seven at the University of Virginia. Each year it admits just seven members. The roster is so secretive that members' names are revealed only upon death, when the Seven sends an arrangement of black magnolias in the shape of the number seven to the funeral. In fact, that's how people learned Robert F. Kennedy was a member after his assassination in 1968. Now, he must have been an exception to the rule that had to attend University of Virginia, because he did his undergrad work at Harvard and went to law school at UVA. Only the super wealthy and accomplished are ever tapped for membership, which makes it one of the most exclusive clubs on the planet, academic or otherwise. The Seven's origins are as mysterious as the group itself. One legend says that it started when some guys met for a poker game and formed the Seven because the eighth man never showed up. In the more than 100 years since it formed, the Seven has become known for its charitable endeavors and commitment to the university and its community. 2012, after a series of horrific events shook the campus, a sexual assault, a hate crime, and the death of a student, the Seven hung banners around campus calling for unity and for students to be kinder to each other. They also raised money for student scholarships, usually in the form of a number followed by a lot of sevens. For example, $17,777.77. And awards an annual $7,000 grant to a teaching assistant nominated by the student body. Now, the society is elusive, but its cryptic symbol is painted in the bricks in the center of campus. After the 1968 graduation, the Seven donated a sundial. It replaced an older one that had occupied that spot for many, many years. Let's go to Washington and Lee University, the Cadaver Society. Now, people have whispered for decades that the group roams through secret tunnels under the campus, but nobody's been able to find those tunnels to prove whether or not it's true. The group is supposed to have started in 1957. Now, I will say, in my experience, underneath most universities, especially the older ones, there are steam tunnels. At the Citadel, enterprising students actually broke into the steam tunnels and set up a club. Now, you can tell a lot about a secret society by just how secret it is. For instance, if it's just rumored the group exists, but nobody's really sure, then it's a seriously secret society. Which brings us to the Cadaver Society. People believe that a group of pre-med juniors with top GPAs are tapped each year to join for the following academic years, but members are completely anonymous to outsiders. Now, next to nothing is known about the group's internal structure or rituals, but it's known for nighttime pranks, like wearing dark cloaks and masks after dark and vandalizing school buildings, landmarks, which is a symbol, cartoonish skull inside a large sea. You've also said to have left it on the hill above the football stadium before games. Now, there are a lot of other rumors about the group, though none have been officially confirmed, including the fact that they use secret tunnels beneath the campus to move around undetected. It's whispered that members have also carved their symbol into the lungs of cadavers in the school's medical lab, and that the initiation involves watching the movie Frankenstein while sitting in the kiddie pool filled with cherry jello. You can tell that's a really serious secret society. One certainty, though, is the group's philanthropy. Back in 1988, the cadavers donated $150,000 to renovate frat houses on campus. And in 1997, they established a scholarship fund for one lucky incoming first-year student every 4 years. The group often refers to itself as a friend of the university, but most people understand with a wink and a nod who that friend really is. But whatever you may think, nighttime in Lexington, Virginia is when the Cadaver Society comes out to play. Well, let's go to New York University. The Euclidean Society. Formed in 1832, the group was briefly called the Raven Society in honor of the Edgar Allan Poe poem. But these days, it appears to be mainly comprised of literature students. You know a secret society's got some serious influence when you can get a famous author to come and address a gathering. New York University's Euclidean Society's in the Academic Secret Society Hall of Fame because the members are able to wrangle none other than Edgar Allan Poe to appear as a guest speaker. Now, initially, the group was more of a debating, book-lending, and literary society that had its own space in the school's main building in Manhattan's Greenwich Village. For more than 100 years, starting the year instruction began at NYU, the Euclidean Society operated on campus, offered in conjunction with a sister organization, the Philomathean Society. They published literary journals and humor magazines, such as the Knickerbocker, the Medley, and the Geyser, in limited runs in the early 1900s. But in 1942, rumor is the group disbanded, not mentioned again in the school's directories. Now, that's the official version. Rumors of the club's existence persisted, though, in a more secretive way. A 2009 prank in which beepers were set to go off at the same time in classrooms all over the school, each sending a cryptic note about the nature of truth and NYU secrets, was attributed to Euclidean Society, even if it hadn't officially existed for more than 50 years by that time. 2017, a group of graduates of the university's creative writing program reformed the group to honor the spirit of the original gathering. It's since opened the group to alumni and current students who seek intellectual and literary exploration, but it's not secret in a true sense of the word. Well, let's talk about fraternities. Now, most college campuses have a lot of secret societies, and they're really not so hidden after all. They call fraternities and sororities, and each has its own traditions, rituals, initiation rites, handshakes, signals, and symbols. And these staples of college life are direct descendants of the more traditional secret societies. The first college fraternity was the Phi Beta Kappa, established at the College of William and Mary in 1775. After the Flathead Club spurned a student named John Heath, unusual things happened. In a fit of pique, he founded Phi Beta Kappa, which was not the kind of fraternity we think of today. Heath and four others established Phi Beta Kappa as an honor society. Within 4 years, it had spawned chapters at Harvard and Yale. And soon after that, new groups were forming at other schools using different regulations and Greek letters and with different parameters. Now, these weren't honor societies like Phi Beta Kappa, which became one of the nation's most prestigious national societies with chapters on 290 campuses, more than 50 alumni associations. But rather the kind of Greek life with which modern students are more familiar. At first, because of the drinking, carousing, and pranks, college administrations frowned on these groups, but as the members became alumni and began exerting pressure and influence and waving their checkbooks around, that opposition turned to grudging acceptance and, in most cases, appreciation. Meanwhile, because it's considered a society, not a fraternity, a student can win Phi Beta Kappa honors while belonging to a fraternity. Naturally, the rise of fraternities led college women to call for a comparable organization, which led to the sorority system. First was Alpha Delta Pi, established at Wesleyan College in Macon, Georgia, in 1851. Phi Beta Phi followed in 1867, and then Kappa Alpha Theta in 1870. Like fraternities, sororities spread like wildfire to more and more colleges. While some schools, like Pennsylvania Swarthmore, have outlawed the Greek system or replaced it with living and eating clubs, as did Harvard and Princeton, most schools consider it an important part of college life. Fraternities and sororities also provide students a place to live by providing members with housing. Now, there are issues with the system. For decades, the use of alcohol and initiation hazing rituals was tacitly accepted. I mean, if you want evidence, look at the 1978 comedy Animal House, which glamorizes superhuman levels of drinking and tomfoolery. In recent years, though, that tolerance has eroded as students have been injured, sexually assaulted, even killed in hazing and drinking incidents. Multiple schools have suspended Greek life for these reasons. After the 2017 alcohol-related death of a Beta Theta Pi pledge at Penn State, the fraternity was permanently banned from the campus. Three students went to jail. The school overhauled its rules about Greek life. The incident was a wake-up call, and many schools have reacted similarly to keep students safe. But the clandestine nature of Greek life remains, and so do the social and business ties that link the members, much like the connections forged in grown-up secret societies. Now let's talk about the category of capital and labor. Now, people on both sides of the eternal divide have had their secret societies. And there's an attraction that's hard to deny. Now, there's nothing secret about how central business is to our world. Capital employs labor to produce goods and services, and everybody participates in one way or another, buying, working, selling, profiting, and so on and so forth. Now, people on each side of that basic equation have always sought like-minded people with whom to share time and ideas and even mutual aid. Or tips about how to maximize productivity and secure better benefits. Sometimes they just wanted a bellyache about heartless bosses or unreliable workers. And these days, you see all that online. But 100 years or so ago, people joined real-life clubs and societies to get things done, talk shop, and have fun. Now, if that sounds like a fraternal order, there are certainly some overlaps. Some of the groups in this area did become fraternal orders and vice versa. Many used Freemasonry-like rituals for initiations and meetings. Now, the groups in this particular realm have operated at varying levels of secrecy and consistency. Labor groups help shape modern unions, which are at a serious low point these days. Three, the Foresters' Friendly Society, the Royal Arcanum, and the Knights of the Maccabees, existed largely to provide insurance benefits to members. And that became central and important, they mutated into full-time insurance companies. Then we have the Veil Profit Organization and the Bohemian Club. Now, these groups had a very dissimilar beginning, but both changed dramatically over time and now are arguably connected by their focus on celebrating location and privilege. There are groups that celebrate having money. Let's talk about the National Grange of the Order of Patrons of Husbandry. That's a mouthful. Formed in 1867, now after the panic of 1873, the patrons established the first of what later be called credit unions as an alternative to banks, which people no longer trusted. And one of the eight founders was, in fact, a woman, which was literally unheard of. Now, typically, secret societies form to exclude others, so it's worth noting. One that was inclusive from the start and created to bolster a community and its livelihood. And even so, it borrowed some rituals from Freemasonry, which gave its events a little pomp and ceremony. Right after the Civil War, President Andrew Johnson charged Oliver Kelly with investigating the state of southern farmlands. Horrified by what he saw, he realized the best way to help southern farmers would be for them to team up with northern farmers to oppose price fixing by middlemen and high railroad shipping cost. So the National Grange was formed to counter these problems. Grange membership more than quadrupled between 1873 and 1875 from about 200,000 to over 858,000. People felt protected by the organization, which worked to regulate rates for rail transport and grain storage. And in the over 150 years since then, the National Grange has promoted altruism and community service. Even today, it charges itself with a grand mission, claiming that it strengthens individuals, families, communities through grassroots action, service, education, advocacy, and agricultural awareness. Now, of course, in this day and time, membership has fallen. I mean, let's face it, farms and farmers have declined in numbers, but as recently as 2005, it had over 160,000 members. And, of course, we have the Molly Maguires that I talked about last week. Formed about 1843, as far as anybody knows. After a series of riots and arrests, the Mollies were hung in Pennsylvania coal country on the same day. 10 Mollies were hung in the Pennsylvania coal country on the same day. That was known as Black Thursday. It was June 21st, 1877. Now, the Molly Maguires became entrenched in American life in the latter half of the 18th century. But they actually started in Ireland a whole lot earlier than that. Northern Ireland saw constant conflict between Catholics and Protestants. And while the Protestants fought via the Pipa Day Boys and the Orange Order, the Catholics fielded first the Defenders and then the Ribbon Men and later the Molly Maguires. Now, Ribbon Men were basically city-based. The Mollies were more rural. That helped in America, where they became a major force in Pennsylvania coal country. And while the Molly Maguires worked to defend and help farmers in Ireland in the 19th century, in the U.S., they worked on behalf of Irish immigrants and miners. They tried to improve conditions by using the same methods of intimidation and violence they'd used to combat landlords in Ireland. When the Panic of 1873 threw America and Europe into financial disarray, the Molly saw it as an opportunity to establish a foothold. But it, unfortunately for them, didn't last. They were decimated by a series of arrests, convictions, and hangings, couple of years later. And even with that dark ending, questions linger to this day about how much influence the Mollies had on the creation of unions. Some say they continued on as the ancient order of Hibernians, but there's little concrete evidence supporting that. In 1970, almost a century after the group disappeared, the Mollies were enshrined on celluloid with a major motion picture starring Sean Connery and Richard Harris. It was called The Molly Maguires. It was a dramatization of events of 1876. Now, the story follows a group of Irish immigrants who rebelled against the poor conditions of Pennsylvania coal mines. And despite mostly good reviews, the film is largely forgotten, rarely mentioned among either actor's career highlights. But it did earn an Oscar nomination for set decoration, which I guess was something. Well, let's talk about the Knights of Labor, which was another work-related organization. It was founded about 1869. It was fairly inclusive, open to both Catholics and Protestants, as well as women and blacks. And in spite of its inclusive nature, it did exclude Asians. They were kind of a precursor to the American Federation of Labor, which would eventually become the AFL-CIO, the largest union in America. But the Knights of Labor began December 28, 1869, when a Philadelphia tailor named Uriah Smith Stevens founded a group with other local tailors. Originally a secret society known as the Noble Order of the Knights of Labor, grew to national prominence in 1873 after the collapse of the National Labor Union left a void that needed to be filled. Throughout the 1870s, as American workers became increasingly militant, thousands joined labor unions. Soon the Knights of Labor was much more than a secret society. With new leadership under Terence Powderly, the group's membership and influence grew, especially after the Great Railroad Strike of 1877. In less than 10 years, there were more than 700,000 members, with the organization committed to establishing an 8-hour workday, ending child labor, and instituting a graduated income tax. The riots in Chicago's Haymarket Square on May 4, 1886, led to a nationwide crackdown on the unions, and that, combined with the Great Panic of 1893 and the rise of the American Federation of Labor, led to the end of the Knights of Labor, though there are rumors that it still exists in the shadows. Let's talk about the Foresters' Friendly Society. Started in 1834. The organization has long used Robin Hood and his merry band of figures as initiation rituals and ceremonies. Founded as the Ancient Order of Foresters, the group is directly related to one of the world's oldest societies. Way back in the 14th century, in rural England, a friendly society was supposedly founded to care for the sick. It evolved into the Royal Foresters in the 18th century and it became the Ancient Order of Foresters in 1834. That's when they dropped initiation by combat. Now that's the way there ought to be initiations in groups. Soon there was an American counterpart charged with helping people as they walked through the forest of life, which meant helping with financial assistance and advice as well as insurance. Early on, members contributed a little money every week, which went into a fund to help members when they needed it, typical of what most of these societies did. As the group became part social order, part financial firm, it fell prey to morally weak individuals. In the 1990s, the state of New York investigated it for fraud and ultimately fined it more than $150 million. Now headquartered in Toronto, the Foresters give members financial planning and retirement advice, lower insurance premiums, and investment guidance. Also, they foster a sense of community. Each member belongs to a local court that answers to a regional assembly overseen by the International Assembly. The organization has more than 2 million members and spends millions yearly on scholarships and community initiatives. The Ancient Order split from the British Foresters Friendly Society decades ago, but they do maintain friendly relations with what they call their sister organization. Then we have the Royal Arcanum, founded in 1877. The American Fraternal Alliance, an umbrella organization for fraternal orders, was established in 1913. Royal Arcanum is the only founding group still in existence. Now, has there ever been a more public founder of Samaritan secret societies than Darius Wilson? The Boston doctor believed in community support so much that he helped create the Knights of Honor, the American Legion of Honor, and the Royal Society of Goodfellows. While belonging to the Order of United American Mechanics, the Ancient Order of United Workmen, the Freemasons, and the Odd Fellows. And he still found time to co-found the Royal Arcanum in 1877. And it was founded for the express purpose of offering its members injury, illness, life, and death insurance. Now, the group's public face focuses on insurance, uniting fraternally all eligible male and female persons of sound bodily health and good moral standing who are socially acceptable, giving moral and material aid to members and their dependents, and teaching morality without religious distinction, patriotism without partisanship, and brotherhood without creed or class. Well, welcoming words notwithstanding, this group still has its secrets. The Royal Arcanum three-tiered system features subordinate councils, grand councils, and supreme council. It focuses on rituals that employ the number 1105, which is incorporated into the group's trademark. It's a Boston-based group that remains a successful insurance company and benefit society that helps members stay active in various volunteer activities. Well, on that note, we're going to end tonight's show because we're not out of time. We'll be back tomorrow when we talk about the Knights of the Maccabees. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.